All right. Well, I want to welcome all of you to our seminar on teaching theater arts in a small school. My name is Betsy Lipton. And before I get started, I just want to check and find out who my audience is. Just by a show of hands, how many of you are actually the drama teachers at your school? Teaching drama, figuring out. Okay, great. How about any administrators? Okay, parents who are wondering what their kids are doing in drama class? Fantastic. Okay, great. And then, I guess, am I missing any major groups? People who want to start a drama department. Fantastic. How many of you are out there? Oh, well, hey. Fantastic. Okay. Well, that kind of starts on my next set of questions, which is, in coming to this seminar, I'm kind of hoping to find out what exactly you guys are hoping to come away with. How many of you are kind of hoping to get sort of a broad idea about how to start and run, just in general, a drama department? Okay. And then how about those of you who are looking for more practical applications, much more small? Okay, great. Is there anything else that I'm leaving out in before I get started? Anybody have any major new teachers? Aha, yes. Yes. Fantastic. Oh, yes, that is a good one. I've got an outline there for you guys, and there's a whole lot of information in there, and basically what I did was I tried to cover everything because I wasn't sure if we would have an administrator-heavy audience or a drama teacher-heavy audience. And so what we'll do is we'll probably go over some points briefly and other points in more depth, and then I think what we'll probably do is I'll stop periodically for questions if that might be easier for you guys. Just by a show of hands, how many of you would probably prefer to stop as we go for questions rather than wait till the very end? Doesn't really matter. Yeah? Okay, great. And okay, well then let's go ahead and get started. On my outline, as you guys can see, I start out by just posing the question, why should we be teaching theater in the classical Christian school? I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this because I think we're probably on the same page, but just in general, I think it's important to acknowledge that in drama class, at least in my program, my goal is not to create a bunch of Oscar award-winning actors out there. However, I do want to equip them with the tools so that if a student does want to go on and study drama or pursue acting, that they are ready, that I'm not throwing them to the wolves, that they'll be skilled, they'll be ready to go. But really what my goal is in my department and at Regents, is we are hoping to help our children, we're hoping to teach our children how to intelligently engage in this media-driven culture. It's very, very important that our children learn how to recognize the worldviews that they're being confronted with in movies, in films, even in music, in all these different things. And in drama, through a series, and we can talk about this later on in the discussion, by doing script analysis, by studying plays, by studying the playwrights, the theater movements that these plays come out of, the students start to think more analytically. They start to kind of pull it apart and figure it out. And in general, it helps them engage rather than, you know, we want to avoid mindless amusement, just watching films or watching plays just to entertain ourselves, because it really is a powerful tool. As you all know, theater, film, music, all of the arts really are incredibly powerful tools, and they can be used in wonderful ways to glorify God and to develop our children and to teach them. But we really do want to avoid, we do want to avoid just telling our kids, just go out there, watch whatever you want to watch, and don't think about what it is that you're watching, because that's when you start to slide into dangerous conflicts of worldview and figure, and you become susceptible to a lot of things. So, number one, we want our kids to be able to intelligently engage in our culture. Number two, it's really important as we are growing these kids up to be the next leaders, the Christian leaders in our communities, for them to be able to present themselves with poise, with grace, to be able to plant themselves and speak. And I'm not just talking about speaking in front of an audience. I'm not just talking about political leaders or pastors or teachers. I'm talking about moms who are raising godly kids. I'm talking about people who are at their job and become social leaders. We want our children to be able to engage in a group and to be able to plant their feet and really, really communicate effectively. So drama, teaching drama obviously is a huge tool in doing that. So those are kind of the basic points. Sorry, it's kind of hot up here as well. Those are the basic points about why we kind of we focus on drama just in a theoretical sense. Also, in terms of, and by the way, please raise your hand. I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to go through these kind of quickly, just because I think more of the focus of today's speech is going to be more about practical application. But we can use drama to develop analytical thinking in our kids. We can teach them through script analysis, through characterization, by giving them problem-solving projects, whether it's in technical theater or in the actual presentation, the acting in theater. They really do develop an ability to think analytically. And we're going to go over some tactics for how to approach that later on, but I'm just going to hit these points. Creative thinking, obviously, that's a no-brainer. Staging choices, designing, creating, it's all part of the whole mix. So what we're going to do right now, actually, is I'm going to ask a couple of questions just to start off. I'm actually going to set that aside for a second. All right. How many of you, I think I saw a few of you, how many of you are starting a drama department right now? Yes. All right. Does anybody have any, what are you hoping to get out of a drama department? Why does your school want the drama department? Or why do you, anybody?
Our school is kind of focused on fine arts.
Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. Okay.
We focus on fine arts.
Okay. Okay, great. So what she said, for those of you who may not have been able to hear, is they've got a focus on fine arts. They're not necessarily a Christian school, but they do have a classical model. And oops, did I kick? Oh, thank you very much. And they have an emphasis on fine arts. Anybody else? Yes. And you want to use them. That's a very good thing. When you have teachers who've got the degrees in fine arts and in theater and you want to use them, fantastic. Okay, so when we were starting our drama department here at Regent School of Austin, we really didn't have much. We were a very sports-oriented school. We had a lot of support for athletics, and we had some music, and we had some small drama things in the classroom, but we really didn't have much drama. We didn't really have drama classes. And the first thing we did was, and I can't actually take credit for this. Our grammar school, the head of our grammar school is a fantastic woman. Her name is Doreen Howell. And they started incorporating drama into the classroom. And the way they did this was they started days like To Kill a Mockingbird Day, French Revolution Feast Day, Monk Day. And the first year I was teaching, I remember I actually taught a few art classes while I was teaching drama. And I saw the kids all walking down the hall in robes like this, with the teacher following them with a little boom box with Gregorian chants, and the kids were all walking. You had a couple, at the beginning of the day, the kids were really into it. They were walking around like, I'm a monk, I'm a monk. By the end, they were kind of starting to get antsy. And when they came into my classroom, I said, hey, what's going on? And they said, well, the teachers made us take a vow of silence because it's Monk Day. Which wasn't, I'm sure the teachers enjoyed it, but the kids weren't too keen on it. They got a little glimpse into what it was to be a monk and the discipline and the focus that was involved in that world. Now, obviously, the teachers talked about other things, but it was just kind of a little funny. That was my first introduction to theme days at Regents. We went on, and later on in the year, I saw kids showing up, and one day they showed up in these bonnets, and some kids looked like peasants, and they had their teeth all blacked out, and other kids were all dressed up in these big gowns with these big wigs. And I said, what in the world is going on at this school right now? And they said, well, it's French Revolution Feast. And one kid chimed out, and she goes, I get to throw food to the peasants. And basically, what the kids did was we divided up the kids. We had peasants and we had the aristocracy, and the aristocracy sat on this big balcony on what is now the School of Rhetoric, and they had a feast. And the peasants stood down below, and they had a script. The teachers came up with this fantastic script for both parties, and they would go through the script, and the kids would beg for food, and if the rich people wanted to, they would toss food down, and it was fantastic, and all the kids loved it. You know, it was kind of a dogfight sometimes. Sometimes the kid wanted to be the peasant and get all dirty and gross, and other kids were like, I am the queen. But it was really fun, and the kids got into it, and what you saw was... not only were they getting to do some drama, not only were they getting to put on costumes and get involved, but they were exploring history in sort of a three-dimensional way. They weren't just reading the facts and seeing pictures of the costumes. They had to go create their costumes. They had to explore the social dynamics between the parties. And there's something about speaking the words. There's something about standing there and calling out to somebody and having them deny you food and then kind of going... okay, I don't like that. And then all of a sudden the kids, it got kind of heated a couple times when the kids were feeling like they were getting denied. And then the rich kids were kind of enjoying the power. And it was really, really fascinating to watch it play out. We also have a day called To Kill a Mockingbird Day where the kids, after they've read the book, will dress up like their favorite character. They'll have a Southern dinner on our art deck. And they'll talk about the characters. They'll talk about the book. And again, it's just a way to engage the kids, to get them into the story, to get them experiencing the story in a different way. I do this a lot in my drama classes, and for those of you who don't go to a Christian school, this may not apply to you, but my school is a Christian school, and so I will use Bible verses or more Bible stories in my drama classes. And the reason I do this is because at my school, we do a lot of scripture memorization. It's a huge part of what we do, partially because we figure if you're going to have the kids memorizing something, why not have them memorizing great stuff that they're going to carry with them? But one reason I do it is because, I'll give you an example. We did one day in my fourth grade, and I granted most of you are logic and rhetoric, but this is an example that can extend into logic and rhetoric. We did in the fourth grade, Joseph and his coat of many colors. And all the kids knew the story. We started out with the conversation about, okay, who knows the story? And the hands went up like, heard it, done it, been there. I'm in fourth grade. I don't need this baby stuff. You know, and I said, well, okay, stick with me on this. So we discussed it, and I asked them all questions about the story, about Joseph, about his brothers. And the kids gave me the pat answer. The brothers were jealous. Joseph did this. And we went through it, and all the answers were correct. But then the next drama class, we actually staged the story. And when we staged the story, interesting things started happening. The kids who were the brothers and the kids who were the kid who was Joseph, they were starting to play out the conversations between the brothers and Joseph. And what happened was all those kids started tapping into that sibling thing that you have, that dream of throwing your brother into a pit and then selling him to slave traders. They all got into that. Well, the jealousy, they figured it out. When they started speaking the words, all of a sudden they started to tap into that. They were like, oh, yeah, I get why they would be kind of angry with him. And by extension of that, when the kids who played Joseph were playing Joseph, they started to realize that some of the things Joseph was saying were kind of irritating. And all of a sudden, new pieces of the story came alive for these kids. And when you do that, again, it's a three-dimensional look at stories. When you start acting and speaking and moving and interacting with other actors, all of a sudden, it clicks. One thing that I'm from the North, and I had the privilege of studying theater in Stratford, Ontario, with the Shakespeare Company there. And one of the things we did when we got up there was we all had these monologues that we had to do as our introductory kind of studio project. And we all thought we were hot stuff. And we were like, I'm here. I'm going to present for you. And you're going to love me. Well, our director was, our teacher at the time was, I think she was the Canadian National Theatre Director. So she was something phenomenal. And we were all so ready to impress her. And she wasn't impressed at all. And I remember I had a monologue for Joan La Pucelle from one of the Henrys, by Shakespeare, and I was Joan of Arc, and it was this monologue pleading with the men on the jury about how she was a maiden and she had never dabbled in witchcraft, and I did it, and I cried, and I wept, and I gnashed my teeth, and I thought it was phenomenal, and then she was like, no, I didn't buy it. And what she did was she put me, I was thinking about it. I was very cerebral about it. I was like, now I'm going to hit drop to my knees and weep and then look up and the beam of light will hit my face. I mean, I had it all planned. And I was very impressed with myself. But she said, no, take it all away. Forget it. Forget everything you did. Think about the words. I was like, okay, I've got the words. They're in my brain. And she took my classmates, there were about 10 of us, and stood them right in front of me. She said, say it to them. So I started doing it. And she got in there with them, and they started kind of closing in on me. She's like, we're going to close in on her. So they started closing in on me. And, of course, my knee-jerk reaction is to kind of go like this. And then even when you know it's fake, that panic thing kind of kicks in. So I started reacting to them. Then she started giving them direction to respond to me in kind of an aggressive or violent way. So all of a sudden, by the end of that monologue, I was shaking, I was cold, I was yelling, and they were yelling back because I was put into the situation. It wasn't something that I thought up, wrote it down, put it over here, framed it in a nice little picture frame, and it's acting. I thought about it, and then I did it. And so one thing that has been a huge tool in building our theater program at school really had nothing to do with me. It had to do with our amazing grammar school and the fact that they realized that a way to reach the kids using theater is by using theater. They throw it in everywhere, man. They have a medieval feast where the kids are all dressed up and they have this long banquet table. And actually, I think their parents serve them, which is kind of fun. The kids enjoy that. And they have medieval entertainment and music and they eat the food. And it's just so exciting for them. So then by the time they start getting a little older, we start saying, okay, it's time for production. They're ready to go. Another thing they do in the grammar school that has built up our program, and again, I know most of us are logic and rhetoric, but I am talking about grammar school because that's where we kind of started and grew up from, is there's tons of recitation, tons and tons of memorization and recitation. One of the most important things you can do is get your kids in front of an audience as much as possible. The more they do it, the more comfortable they're going to be with it, and they are just going to... We have a thing called senior thesis at our school where the seniors write this thesis and present it before a panel and a huge audience, and then they have to defend their thesis. I mean, it's pretty remarkable, actually. And these kids, by the time they're 18, because they've done so much presentation and recitation at our school, get up there, and they're going. I would sign them up for any law firm, any political office. These kids are ready to go because they've done it. So that's another thing you can do is just really start getting them in there. One thing that has been a tool that I use that I've found to be really effective in getting kids excited about drama department, whether it's just class or whether it's production, is incorporating as much as we possibly can that interests the kids. You got to know your kids. You got to know who they are and what their interests are. I'll give you an example. We were at the very beginning of our drama program. We were involved in a junior high, a school of logic competition, PSIA. And we did one-act plays, 40-minute plays that we would go and compete with. And we're going to talk about competition and festivals later. But we would go and compete with these. And you would be ranked. You would be the state champion or you would be the state loser, whatever, it depends. And I was really met with a task when I was picking the plays. I had to be really careful about how I picked my shows because the program hadn't had a lot of popularity yet. I had to really think about who my kids were, what they'd want to do. Well, the first year, I tended to pick, I'll cover this later, but I tended to pick public domain things, classics, a lot of Shakespeare, Moliere, Chekhov, all those things, because you can cut them and you don't have to worry about royalties, you don't have to worry about publishers' rights, anything like that. It's a dream come true. You can go to places like Project Gutenberg online, has pretty much every single script you could possibly imagine that's in public domain. They even have Project Gutenberg. And if you just Google it, you'll find it. And you can search either by title, by author. And they even have, they'll have Chekhov in English, Russian, and Italian. I mean, you can pick anything. So I started out nice and simple. I was like, we're a classical school. I love Shakespeare. I know Shakespeare. I've done Shakespeare. I picked something that was very familiar to me so that it was one of the first shows that I really directed at the school. And to be safe, when you start out, pick something you really know. It doesn't hurt to pick something you've done, something you've directed, something you've seen 100 times, because there's nothing like flying blind when you're directing. You know how many things can go wrong when you're directing. Well, pick something you know. So I had been in Midsummer a couple times. I've seen it. I said, okay, I'll pick Midsummer Night's Dream. I can cut it easily. It's got lots of room for lots of roles. And the nice thing about that, and the nice thing about Shakespeare in general, is in terms of rehearsing, it's compartmentalized. Midsummer has three plot lines. It's got the lovers, it's got the fairies, and it's got the rude mechanicals. And the great thing is, especially with younger kids who don't have a lot of time to rehearse, is you can rehearse them in chunks. You can have the rude mechanicals on Monday. You can have the lovers on Tuesday. You can have the fairies on Wednesday. You can have to be announced on Thursday for problem scenes. But that way the kids don't have to come every single day, and you don't have to worry about kids sitting around, getting bored, getting into trouble, distracting each other. So that was another reason I picked it. I said, okay, we can break it up. It'll be nice and easy. So we picked it, and the kids were kind of, they were thinking it was okay. They do a lot of Shakespeare at school, so they were kind of into it. So I decided we were going to make it a little more interesting. So we started talking about different approaches we could take to Midsummer. I said, okay, if you could do anything, the great thing about Shakespeare is you can do anything with it. As long as you're true to the text, you can pick all sorts of themes, design concepts, anything. What's interesting to you? And the boys, of course, were like, we want to, like, kill people. We want to fight. We want swords. And the girls, of course, were like, we want things to be beautiful. And the boys all gagged. And I'm sitting here going, oh, what have I done? Why did I open this up? And then we had a thought. A long time ago in college, and now this book has nothing to do with Midsummer Night's Dream, but I read a book called Death in Midsummer. It's a Japanese book. And I started thinking Midsummer and colors and Death in Midsummer, my Japanese book, let's do kabuki. Let's make it kabuki. So we did a kabuki-style Midsummer Night's Dream. And this worked for a lot of reasons. The boys got to have their big swords and these crazy costumes. The girls got these beautiful dresses with these obis and their wigs. They all got to wear wigs. And another thing we got to do, which was very helpful, these are School of Logic kids who haven't really done much theater. And I don't know about any of you guys, but when I approach my School of Logic kids about anything, there's immediate self-consciousness. I don't want to do that. I don't want to look stupid. I don't want people to look at me and know what I'm doing. I can't emote. I can't weep. I can't. So we put them in full kabuki makeup so you couldn't tell who anybody was. It was a mask. And all of a sudden, these kids were released to do what they did best. They were great actors, smart kids, creative kids. And it was that inhibition that was really locking them in, that was keeping them. So we covered their faces. Now, obviously, it was makeup, so you could still move your face and everything, but it was enough for them. They had wigs. They had makeup. Some of the parents were even like, which one's that? I can't tell. Oh, that's my kid. Oh, sorry. It was fantastic. And so all of a sudden, the boys got their swords. The girls got to be beautiful. They got this great makeup, and they went with it. Plus, it was different. It wasn't the Shakespeare that was, I'm standing here. Now I'm going to talk to you like this and bore you to tears. It was new. It was fun. And then throw on top of that the fact that we made that show physical. And I am always a big fan of making Shakespeare as physical as possible. It's supposed to be physical. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be crazy in places. And so that fight between the lovers, we made that like the WWE, man. We were lifting girls and throwing girls, which the boys loved. And they were like, I can lift you, no problem. It was fantastic. And the kids went with it. So we tapped into who these kids were and what their interests were, and we went with it. The next year, again, we had a lot more interest. I think for Midsummer, we had 26, 27 kids audition. The next year, we did Macbeth. And we had over 80 kids audition, over 80 kids just show up to audition. And everyone that I talked to was like, are you kidding? Macbeth with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders? Yeah, have fun with that one. And I said, nope, I know we can do it. Now, we're going to have a conversation about content and plays and everything, and we're going to come back to Macbeth. But I'll tell you why I picked Macbeth. I had a ton of boys, And I had some great girls, too. And when I looked at the boys that I had and the girls that I had, I realized that the girls I had were very creative, kind of wanting to explore deeper acting. And you look at the witches, you look at Lady Macbeth, you look at all these different female roles in that show, and it was perfect for them. And, of course, you get to tell the boys they get to sword fight, and I mean, you just give them the plot of Macbeth, and they're like, yes, I'm with you. They were ready to go. And so, and when we did it, the kids, again, they just jumped in, and they were owning that. Now, in Macbeth, I added a Greek chorus element to Macbeth. What we did was, when we approached Macbeth, obviously, a play about a man who goes on a mass killing spree to gain power, and I think at the end his head's severed, and everyone's like, yay! I mean, it's pretty dark. At the end, you've got witches, and you've got people conjuring spirits. It's a lot. It's a lot for anybody, let alone 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, right? So the first thing I did was I was very careful about cutting. I cut that down, and I kept things. I kept the witches. I kept different aspects. I actually did cut out the come spirits on Sex Me Here speech where Lady Macbeth was conjuring, because I thought it was a little gratuitous. We had enough. And the way we staged it was very, I was very careful about staging things so that it was very clear. But one thing we did was add a chorus of tempters, for lack of a better word, and it became a very practical function of the play as well. We had these hooded people, and I have some photos that I can show you. We had these hooded people that walked around, and every time Macbeth started to sort of feel that temptation crawl up his shoulder, we had the tempters kind of ease in. They first showed up at the beginning. We actually opened with the witches in the middle, and they started out the play, and we kind of added this. We took text from the back of the play and put it in the front. One of the teachers told me in Stratford was, cut Shakespeare, move Shakespeare around, it's not the Bible. Now, granted, she may have been drugged out and burned as a heretic, a Shakespearean heretic, you know, the next week. I don't know. But it stuck with me. And it's true. He's brilliant. He's amazing. And you know what? He's not God. So chop him up, move him around, do whatever. So we took lines from the back of the play and we put them at the beginning. We had the witches start saying the different titles that enticed Macbeth. Thane of Cawdor, great Glum, thou shalt be king. And they started low, and we had this chorus behind them, kind of in a circle. It looked kind of druidy and kind of creepy. And they built and they built, and the chorus came up, and we opened the show that way to establish that we were going to have a chorus. This is we're laying it down, expect this. They showed up again when Macbeth and Banquo are walking through the forest, and they run into the witches. And we had kind of this group of, and they looked very kind of organic-y, and it was dyed cheesecloth, and they almost looked like part of the earth. It was really gross and cool. And so they looked like rocks. They were kind of down like this, and then they kind of started to swirl up when Macbeth kind of, when they started telling him, thou shalt be king. And all of a sudden, you heard the chorus would go, great Glums, worthy God. And they started whispering the things that tempted Macbeth. And we plugged that in so that you could see the physical, the inner workings of his brain. You physically were staging it. And it kept going. And when he did that great speech about, is this a dagger before me? And he's holding out his hand. And he's deciding, is this the moment when I'm going to go kill the king? Am I going to kill this man who I've been so loyal to and loved for so long? We had the chorus kind of start coming in. They started easing in and start whispering those titles to him again. And as they built and as they rose in volume, they started coming in and coming closer. And then it chimed, and he did his classic, his famous, the bell doth call me. He was ready to go. He'd made his choice. And from then on, we kept using those chorus members. And actually, we ended up using them when Banquo came in, Banquo's ghost. We dressed him as a chorus member. And occasionally, he would whip off his hood, and you'd see him, and then he'd throw it back on and dive back into the mix of the chorus. And it was actually a fantastic form fits function kind of a thing. It was functional, but it also had kind of a theory behind it. So it was really exciting. And of course, I'll tell you right now, I'm a big fan of the Greek chorus. Anywhere I can throw one in, I will. It's a way to get kids involved. It's beautiful. It's classic. And it's really effective. I mean, when you get all sorts of people saying the same thing at the same time, you get to explore beautiful movement. It's just phenomenal. It's a great device. There's a reason the Greeks used it. It was phenomenal. And really, the kids really enjoy it. At first, they kind of look at you like, I'm not doing that. And by the end, they're all really into it. So I love using the chorus. And really, they're kind of that blank. They can be anything. You can use them. And we used one, actually, we threw one in when we did Mary Zimmerman's The Odyssey, which is Greek, but had no chorus. We threw it in when we did the underworld scene. We can talk about that later. But let's talk briefly about play selection and content, since I just went over Macbeth and how we went through that. I will tell you, at a classical Christian school, it is incredibly difficult to pick a play to do. We have high standards of, you know, academic standards. We're very concerned about content and exposing our kids to things that they may not be ready for. Age is an issue. And then, of course, you've also got the deal, I've got lots of girls, I've got no boys, I've got some boys, I've got no girls. We only have an hour to practice every day. You've got so many things going that It's a wonder we don't throw our hands up and go, ugh, forget it. I don't care. I'll tell you how I approach picking a play. And then I'll come back to Macbeth as an example. I kind of approach it from a number of angles. I first think about what can I live with for a couple months, a couple weeks, three months, however long it takes to do the play. What can I do obsessively for a few months and not want to kill myself? What am I going to be able to handle, right? Because you got to live with it. You're the one doing it every day for hours on end. It's you. So you got to think of that first. Second, like I mentioned before, you got to know who your kids are and what they're going to be interested in. Not that you want to always pander to kids, because obviously you're the teacher and you know a little bit more than they do, obviously, but you do need them to go along with you. And you don't want to just hit them with something. If you've got tons of boys and you say, okay, we're doing Little Women, guess how many people are going to come audition for your show, you know? So you've got to be aware of that. You've got to think about your parents. What kind of things, I mean, are they going to want to see their child up there doing this play? Are they going to be wondering if you're the best person to be directing drama for their child? You've got to think about that. You've got to think about your administrators, and not just from, I always ask my administrators for their opinion, and it's not necessarily because I'm expecting them to give me crazy off-the-wall answers or guidelines. It's more that they really have their pulse on the school. Your head of school knows what's going on in the school. He knows their families. He knows your kids. And he can give you some guidance. Plus, they know what direction they want the school to be going in. So they can really help guide you. When I looked at Macbeth, I'll give you that as our example. I'll go back to Macbeth. I first thought, okay, I love this story. I think it's fantastic. It's exciting. I can live with that. Kids, we've already covered that. Kids are okay. Parents, administrators, I thought for a minute and I was kind of like, okay, how am I going to pitch this one and should I pitch this one? Because at the end of this, if you can't find a good way to justify it to your parents, you shouldn't be doing it. If you don't have a good reason why this show is going to enrich their children, don't do it. Don't do it. Our job is to enrich our children. It's not to put on the Bessie Lipton show. I am amazing. Look at the show I do. No, it's about the kids. And so you really have to be aware of how you're going to be affecting them. Well, Macbeth, it is a dark show, as I mentioned earlier. So I looked at it and I said, okay, why do I like this play? I like this play because it really is a beautiful picture of temptation, of making choices, of consequences, of wrong versus right. Don't forget, Macbeth was considered a great hero, a great man, a wonderful man, before he fell and into his downward spiral. And I thought it was an incredible picture of how none of us are immune to temptation. That was my jumping off point. The kids and I really explored different themes about the consequences of the choices you make, crossroads, and different elements in that regard. So we really explored the biblical themes just in general. And when we came out of the conversations, the parents that were involved and the kids and I all felt very confident that was the direction we were going to go in. And it really helped us as we went through the play rehearsal process. It helps us stay on track, knowing that, okay, we're making clear distinctions between right and wrong, between the choices and their consequences. We're not going to wallow or glorify in some of the ugliness. We're going to shine a light on the ugliness. And that's really what it came down to. Now, another Shakespearean play that's equally dark in some ways that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole is Titus Andronicus. I don't want to do it. Are any of you familiar with that one? Oh, I had the joy of doing that one in Stratford. Go read it. I'm not going to go over it. It's dark. It's dark and it's ugly. And the reason I don't want to do it personally is to spend that many months on something that intense would probably affect me. I would have a hard time. And if it's going to affect me, it's going to affect my kids, who are probably a little more emotional and wound up. Also, I don't like the end result. I can't personally find redeeming or honest or real meat at the end of it that I feel like I can put on stage and say, I'm going to put my name on this. So that's just my personal opinion. And if you decide you go off and read Titus Andronicus and you can find fantastic things, then fantastic. I personally haven't found that. So anyway, that's kind of a very quick version of how I've selected my plays. Does anybody have any questions so far about how we did that? I'm sorry? I direct plays. I've done all from 5 through 12. I've actually done 1st through 12. Right now, I'm mainly doing rhetoric. I have done logic. And they are different. It's a different beast. The logic kids are a little bit more insecure. As they get into rhetoric, they're a little bit more willing to take chances, but not as much. I mean, you still have the girls who want to be beautiful and the guys who want to be tough, and all the girls are like, oh, I'm old this time. Can you give me a pretty role next time? Oh, and that's a fun conversation. The whole, okay, no, this is about exploring the character. It doesn't matter. They don't want to look ugly in front of their peers. So, I mean, you're still going to have that, but in the school of logic, maybe it's that they're more rambunctious about it, or they're just kind of coming into that awareness of self-awareness. That it is a little bit more difficult to pick things that are going to make your younger kids feel safe. Mm-hmm. Oh, the first, second, and third grades? There is a lot of that. You can do one thing that I really enjoyed doing with the younger grades is we would take books that we really enjoyed, and we would stage them. I'll tell you one thing that I do with my younger kids, because it can be applied to the older kids. I break down everything we do. We break it apart. We smash it. We pulverize it. I don't know if any of you are familiar with, this is an example I give to my kids, the artist Chuck Close. Any of you familiar with him? Okay, he does these huge paintings. Actually, some of you have probably seen a Chuck Close-esque poster. He did this thing where he would do portraits of people in a grid, lots and lots of grids. It was like pointillism, a modern approach to pointillism or pixelization. And in every square, he would do these circles or these blotches of color. And when you stepped back, it really looked like a photograph. But these things were huge. I mean, you had to go a ways back. But when you were really close, you could see all this stuff. And I remember as a little girl, my mom worked at the Art Institute in Minneapolis, and there was a Chuck Close painting. It was huge. It looked like a photo. And I remember the woman who was teaching us about it telling me that he had painted the painting with razor blades, that detailed. And that's really the approach that I take with my kids, whether it's grammar, logic, or rhetoric, in studying drama. We pull everything apart, because if you don't know all the little mechanics of what makes something, it doesn't matter how great the end product that you're looking at is. If you don't know how to get there, there's no point. So I break up voice with the younger kids. Especially, we do voice exercises where we'll do a lot of recitation. We'll explore character, presenting character through the voice. We'll talk a lot about, you know, obviously volume and support and diction and things like that. And then one thing that I do that's really fun with the younger kids, and even the logic kids have really enjoyed doing this, is we'll do just physical movement. And you can do pantomime. I understand the point of pantomime. I just don't like it. So what we do is we watch Charlie Chaplin movies. We watch Charlie Chaplin. We watch The Kid. I think this year we watched The Kid. And I told the kids, I was like, okay, I want you to watch this. It's a silent film, and you hear groans, and then they see it's black and white. They're like, oh, you're killing us, lady. They wanted nothing to do with it. But as they watched it, I said, I want you to pay attention to how these characters are showing emotion, how they're showing their relationship with each other through their bodies. Anybody can tell you, I love this guy. But if their body's not showing you that I love this guy, nobody's going to buy it. Okay, it's the same as me in my Stratford class going, oh, no, I'm a maid. And everyone's going, those motions don't match up with what you're saying. So we did these Charlie Chaplin exercises where we watched the movie. We talked about it. And then we did exercises. We made our own silent movies. And it was really fun. And the kids really got into it. And with kids, the more physical you can make it, these kids are rambunctious, they're ready to go, make it physical. Because we have to get away from this, theater is cerebral, we're intellectually superior, we're so artistic, let me put on my beret and my black turtleneck. That's not really what it is. We want it to be fun, we want it to be beautiful and exciting and engaging, and it's physical. When you look at Restoration Theater and Molière and all these guys, Shakespeare, you've got people running in one room, out the other, hiding under a table. It's crazy, and the audience loves it. And that doesn't mean that plot or character has to suffer. It just means it's an element. It's a piece of the puzzle. So when I'm doing... So does that answer your question? Fantastic. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. She asked how we do theater at Regents. Is it part of the curriculum or is it an after-school thing? It's both, actually. We have kind of three pieces to that. We have what I've talked about earlier, which was the grammar school. They constantly are incorporating it in their classrooms. And that's actually the classroom teacher. That's not me. Our fifth graders all do a shortened Shakespeare play that they present. The fourth graders do something. I mean, they do what's called the Ephesians Chapel, where they do the entire book of Ephesians, and they break it up, and every grade, every class does a piece of it. They do all that stuff. Then when you get into logic and rhetoric, and actually we start drama in fifth grade, excuse me. We start drama classes in fifth grade, and it's not really an elective because it is required. Choir and drama are actually required for our students in fifth and sixth grade. And I think that that's probably a good plan. I think all kids need to be able to at least be familiar with singing, and I think that they really need to get used to speaking in front of people. And so in the fifth and sixth grade, we do have a class where they will come for 50 minutes, and we will explore all these things that I'm talking about. We'll do voice, we'll do recitation, we'll do movement, we'll do scene work, we'll do games, and we'll do things like that. And then when you get into logic, the kids can choose. They can choose, I think, two electives per semester. And we have orchestra, we have band, we have drama, we have speech, actually, also. And speech is, I'm not really a speechy person, but speech is a great avenue for some of these kids who have skills in drama, but are more on the, it's more of an academic approach to the acting. So they have that option in logic. And they also have an after-school program where they do a one-act play. So there is an after-school element and there's an in-class element. Then in rhetoric, again, they get to choose their electives, and we have a class in which, you know, we study all this stuff, and then we also have after-school production. And, I'm sorry? No, actually right now it's 2 days a week. We're in the process, you know, our school's growing, buildings are building. We just have to be really careful logistically, just because of space. And the kids at our school, really, they have a lot going on, and it's wonderful that they have a lot going on. So we really try to do the best we can with what we're doing, but also leave them room to be with their families, to go to youth group, to do homework, to be with their friends, to do other activities. So right now it's 2 days a week. We may go up more or less. It just depends. Yes. The after school? Oh, that's a good question. I actually have a piece on my outline that says, how much is too much for rehearsals? And I have to be honest with you, that is actually a huge weakness of mine because I am very OCD. I came from a military family. I acted in professional theater, and I'm very, very careful. So I drive. And sometimes I drive my kids too hard. I forget that they actually need to do homework or see their moms or, you know, sleep. So, and I've driven these kids too hard at times, and my administration or my parents or the kids themselves are wonderful about communicating very lovingly, like, hey, we're dying here. So what I'm learning to do and what I've kind of come to is, what we do is I try to make sure at the logic level, no more than 2 or 3 days a week for maybe an hour or two at the very beginning. And that's still pretty intense for some people. I think you can get away with, depending on how long the play is. And again, this is where knowing what your school's kind of, the ethos of your school really comes in handy. If you're a very fine arts oriented school, you're going to probably spend more time on your fine arts because these kids are coming to you to learn how to be actors, musicians, whatever. If you're a very academically oriented school, you've got to take a slightly different approach. If you're a sports heavy school, you have to take a different approach. What I've come to in my program is with logic, we'll practice 2 or 3 days a week, an hour, maybe two at the very end. In rhetoric, I'm there 5 days a week or 4 or 5 days a week. I try to make sure that the kids aren't there more than three for a couple hours. Now, granted, towards the end, the last 2 weeks of a show, we have every day, and it's for extended periods of time. And when that happens, the moms are great. They volunteer. They bring in food. We have, like, a little dinner powwow with everybody, and it's great. But I would say I tend to give kids, I've started giving kids Fridays off, and the reason I do that is because 3 o'clock on Friday, I'm spent, let alone a teenager. And really, you don't get that much out of them, to be honest. You really don't. They're ready to go home. And some kids are ready to go. They're let's work, let's have Friday, let's have Saturday. Other kids are like, please, let me go home. So it's nice to give them a break. One thing I'm really learning about is stepping back, making choices about what you're going to focus on, and then even if it doesn't get done, you need to rest. And so that's where actually I used to keep, when I first auditioned kids, I used to leave the schedule as kind of a fluid open, whatever we need, we'll do kind of a thing. I started giving myself harder deadlines. In fact, for next year, I've already made my schedules for the fall and the spring plays, because I find that with myself, if I have a hard deadline, I'll meet it. If I don't, I will waste time. I will put things off. I will, and that's not fair to the kids. It's not fair. So when I give myself hard deadlines and I make that schedule and I know I've got 3 days, 2 hours, tough, end at 5 or end at 3 or whenever you end, you make those deadlines and it's really good. And it gives everybody a lot more sense of what they're getting into, and you don't have, you know, dissension among the ranks. You know, people aren't getting frustrated, and it really is helpful. So did I answer that question for you? Okay. Yes. Sure. Okay, that's fine. Why can't we do Disney? You know, that's a great question. I think one thing that we, I'll give you an example. We had a choir director a long time ago. She's not there anymore. Who really wanted for Christmas to do both sacred music, and she wanted to do the Grinch. And she wanted to sing the Grinch. And our administrators let her. They were like, you know what? This is a song. It's part of culture. Go for it. I think, are you more concerned about selling this to a board or getting people on board with you in terms of, hey, let's all be on the same page? Yeah, to avoid that classical, we only do Greek. Okay, so we're going to start brawling. I think we're going to have to divide the audience here. Why can't we do Hannah Montana? Okay, because they watch it enough on TV. To be honest with you, the reason, and I'm kind of one of these people, I'm not one of these people that says, no Disney, yes Shakespeare. No, I can't think of another example. You know, none of this pop culture stuff, only strong, powerful literary canon stuff. I am a big fan of the literary canon. I love that stuff. I think it's great. It's beautifully structured. It's part of, all the kids need to be somewhat familiar with it in order to be able to, their literary allusions are all throughout, you know, our culture. So I do focus on that, but I think that in my life, I approach every play on its own terms, and I think you really have to do that. You can't just say we will only do stuff written before 1900, and that is all. You need to, when you look at a play, you need to look and say, okay, look at the quality. Is the plot, one thing I mentioned in my outline is Aristotle's Six Points of Tragedy, and I'm not going to get into it because that's a speech all into itself. He put spectacle. The reason I put it in there is because he's put spectacle at the very bottom, and he puts plot and character at the top. And I think that that's a good approach to selecting a play. Is the plot well written? Are the characters good? Is there something you can get out of this play? Is it gonna enrich your kid's life in some way? And even if that's just having fun. I love doing comedies. I've actually steered away from more dramatic stuff because I want these kids to enjoy themselves. I want them to have fun. So to answer your question, I think the big thing is, if something is well done, well written, if it stands on its own, regardless of whether it's a purple bunny rabbit or whether it's some, you know, King Lear, as long as it's well written and you can do something with it that's going to engage your kids and engage your audience. And one thing that I do sometimes when I'm doing content that's not necessarily deep and powerful is I like to draw in other elements. I like to draw in music that might be able to enhance the quality. I like to draw in artistic allusions. One thing that we did with the Odyssey, now granted it's the Odyssey, that's not exactly what you're talking about, but one thing we did is it's sort of an eclectic. The version we did, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Mary Zimmerman. She recently won a Tony for putting Ovid's Metamorphoses on Broadway. She does a lot of adaptations. She did the Notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, blah, blah, blah. Well, she does this thing where she takes these plays and she kind of does this eclectic mix of time periods and things like that. And she leaves it open to a lot of interpretation. One thing that I think is extremely fun about putting on a play is you can do anything. As long as you're true to the text, as long as you've broken it down, taken the Chuck Close approach to it, broken it down and found out what the essence of the play is, you can do anything with it. So whether it's a Disney play or whether it's Shakespeare. And so what we did is we broke down an Odyssey and we said, okay, what is absolutely at the core of this show? And once we figured that out, well, it's Greek and it's this classic tale of everything. So one thing we did was, oh, and here's another thing about Mary Zimmerman. All of her shows tend to be people in white with a big skyscape behind them. And then maybe the main character is in some kind of costume that represents some element of their life. For example, when we did the Odyssey, Circe was sort of like a 1930s pinup, beautiful. We had in Phaedra, it's the scene on the beach. Here's an example. This is very unclassical of me. I even said to one of the Latin teachers, I was like, I don't know if you're going to like what I did with this play. Phaedra, it's by the ocean or by the water, and all these people are very kind and warm and loving. And the scene was dead. It was awful. So what we decided to do was make it almost like one of those Annette Funicello beach movies from the 60s. And I have pictures. If we have time, I'll go through these. But I really want to stay on task. And everyone was in their black and white because we established that was the theme. You have the blank palette of throughout the play of the black and white. We put leis on them. They had grass skirts. They were dancing around. And when Odysseus came in, they were like, hey! And he was kind of looking around like, what's going on? You guys are kind of freaking me out. And they were hugging him and bringing him in. And then when Demodocus came in and sang her very dark and depressing song, they all raised their lighters and were... And it was fun. And it worked with the text. They were on the beach. They were warm. They were welcoming. And it worked. Is that what Homer had in mind? Well, obviously not. Annette Funicello was way after him. But still, do you see what I'm saying? You can play with these things. Yes. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, for example, one thing that we started out with, my whole concept for the Odyssey, for example, was this Magritte painting. I thought of Magritte because, you know, she has this very almost modern approach to her plays. And Magritte, the painting I'm thinking of, I'm sure you all know it, it's the sky with the man in the bowler hat and the suit and the green apple in front of his face. And I thought, aha, here we go. Here's a jumping off point. So we put everybody, in fact, let me do this. Let me just go ahead. This is going to be kind of ugly because you're going to see my screen, but I'm going to show you the painting that I looked at, and I'm going to go through all this. Okay, whoops, let me put this on technically savvy me. Okay, this is the painting that I started with, right? And here's another one. So you have these sort of modern mixed with classical elements. Well, one thing that we thought about when we were looking at how we mix the modern and that eclectic feel with the Greek and still maintaining the integrity of all the Greek culture. And so we went with this Magritte theme. And one of the things with the Greek that we really focused on were we added a lot of choral work in, and we added a lot of masks. We did a lot of masks and a lot of movement. And but we also included sort of this Magritte-esque style. So we have this isn't the best angle. We had this big framed sky. We built the sky. We had the frame around it. We put pillars out. And we did sort of some white steps to kind of allude to the Parthenon. And actually what we did is we took the set apart as we went and built boats out of the boxes. We built a pen for the sheep out of the boxes and bamboo rods. It was very innovative. And what it actually ended up doing was allowing us to go through lots of different scene changes and time periods without having to move lots of sets on, worry about time period, anything like that. So here's another kind of a spot. Here's Tiresias. He was in front of the sky. We put a mask on him, put a bowler hat on him, and a suit, and we went there. Well, the underworld actually only had Tiresias, Odysseus, and Odysseus's mother in it. Well, I wanted to keep this Magritte theme going, and I wanted to involve kids, so we put a chorus of sort of underworld spirits, because there's this great line about how he dug a pit and poured the blood of a black lamb into this pit, and the spirits came swarming up, their faces flickering in the dark. So we put in a chorus with these masks, and as you can see, they're not organic, you know, flowy spirits. They almost look like a Fosse show. They've got the bowler hats and the leotards, but they've got the mask. Okay, we've got some more photos of these masks and these hats. There's his mother, and there's them pulling her kind of down in. And we didn't have the means to make her disappear, so we did this great choral movement where they kind of sucked her in. It was great. But so we had that element. We also carried the masks into another form when Circe turns them into pigs. We put masks on bowler hats and made them pigs. And it was great. And it was funny. It was goofy. And the kids were like, okay, how are we going to turn into pigs and not feel like idiots? So we made it funny. And here's some masks. One other thing that we did to lighten the mood in the Cyclops scene, we had this great big silhouette of the Cyclops, this big shadow. We grew this guy to be about 10 feet tall, and the little people that got eaten were really close to the screen, so they looked tiny, and he looked big, and it was great. It's kind of a dark scene, getting your eyes gouged out and people eaten. So we put these sheep in, right? We put these little sheep with these little masks. We made tutus. They were in white leotards. We made these tutus out of this woolly fabric, and we put pink crinoline in. They look like so cute, just little pink bows on their ears, white tights, little black shoes, and they were in the pen, and they would do little things, almost like showgirls throughout the show, and then when the men were escaping with them on their backs, the girls would hop onto their back and go, whee, and the men would run out with them, and you got to laugh every time. It was great. These are the girls in their little masks. But you see, what you have is you're making it fun, and you're bringing cultural. You're drawing on music, on history, on art. And really, that's the beautiful thing about theater is it's a multimedia art form. You have music, you have art, you have history, you have science, you have math. These are all things that really enrich the studies in their other classes. And so that's what I would kind of say to you in terms of, let me see, oh, there's Circe. She was our 1940s pinup. But you see, we had oh, there's Phaedra having fun with their. And it was just, we just had a lot of fun. We made the sirens. We decided we wanted them to look like a painting almost. So we painted them gold. We made them into almost statuesque. We made them into statues. And again, the kids got into it. They got so excited about, well, what if we did this? And they started researching ideas. One of my boys was like, how are we going to do the Gila monster? We want a great Gila monster. And they came up with the idea of doing a Chinese dragon, these huge heads mounted on these things. And these chorus members, in bowler hats, of course, came out and they were weaving around and they devoured poor little, I forget what her name is, it was a long Greek name, but and they devoured, and it was great, but the kids got involved and really started throwing in their own. I don't think we left Penelope sort of as a classic. She was kind of one of those untouchable things. She was such a staple that we left her very classic and stayed with that. But, oh wait, that's another, we'll talk about budget in a second. That was Macbeth. Yeah, for the Odyssey, actually my set probably cost me less than $800. We built just a big frame and painted it, and we bought crown molding at Lowe's, spray painted it gold and stapled it on. We built square boxes out of really cheap plywood and put some handles on them. And one nice thing about when you do this thing with drawing in different elements of, you know, history and art, you can start thinking much more creatively. And all of a sudden, you're not boxed in with this whole idea that I'm doing the Odyssey and I need 15 different sets and I need this and I need this. You can play and you can have fun. So the set wasn't very expensive. Actually, we really, those masks, I think what we did was I found one plastic mold. I got some bandages, you know what doctors use to make casts. I did the basic thing, and then I got this great stuff. I'm sure you guys have seen people use it for trees and things like that. It's this foam that you spray on. It's like insulating foam. We sculpted the masks with that. We sprayed all this stuff on it, and then we painted it. So it was actually really, it wasn't too bad. The budget wasn't too bad. I was going to say the next show, Macbeth, my budget was $500. And what we did, this is one of the witches from Macbeth. Yeah, it was really fun. And that wig cost me $5 with some Elmer's glue, some paint, and some feathers that I dug out. That fabric on her dress is $1.99 muslin and cheesecloth for 79 cents a yard and a lot of Rit dye and spray paint. And it's really, that dress probably cost me $10. The wig probably cost me $7. So here's another witch. And you can see it's just it's more about time. And again, back to the Chuck Close thing is the more layers, the more you break it down and get the more detail. It looks fantastic. Yes. That's a great question. How do we work in the technical studies and work? Yes, we do it all ourselves. The kids absolutely do, and that's part of the whole deal. And in the past, I've done more of it just because we were on time crunches and we had to decide what are we going to have the kids do. I do a lot of prep now. I do a lot of planning and prep, and then we kind of go through the steps. Or we'll talk about it, and then I'll do prep, and then the kids. So I kind of figure out how we're going to do it, and then we walk through it together. Like I made one tutu and kind of worked it out with the girls and then showed them. You know, we, at the moment, we have one class where we actually do have some rehearsal time for the play. And while the actors, I mix it with actors and technical kids. So I get the tech kids started on their project while we rehearse scene work. And tech kids will sometimes work after school while we're rehearsing. A lot of times we'll have a couple tech days on Saturdays. I know when I was in high school it was every Saturday. But nowadays, I mean, you just can't ask kids to do that. So we would take about a Saturday. Oh, and I'm almost out of time. Let me just finish this up. And then if you guys have more questions, I don't mind going on. So that's how we kind of just do it as we go, and it usually works out. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yes, and we're trying to get more of that in. We do most of that stuff in class. We do have scene work and studio work that the kids that aren't in the productions do. Now, in the Odyssey, every kid that auditioned, I actually did cast. I had a cast of over 50. Which was pretty stupid. It was that was a lot of work. I don't know if I'm going to do that again. But I have a hard time saying no to my babies. It's kind of tough. So, we do have some. Oh yeah, no, the fifth graders do have performance opportunities. A lot of stuff that they practice in class. They did. We used to have a thing called Nice Night where the Logic kids would perform. We had to, again, because we need to work with facilities and things like that. We've had to kind of pare down a little bit. So yes. Now I know we're kind of at the end of our time. If anybody would like to stay longer, I can keep talking. I don't want to hold you captive to me. Does anybody have any other questions that they'd like me to kind of cover while we're still here? No. Mm-hmm. Yes. But actually, you know what? I need to give you guys my email address. I have no problem sharing any of the stuff that we've done. We really take. I'm trying to think of how to. There's no easy way to actually go over it. But let me give you my email address in case any of you. I'm sorry. Fantastic. Please feel free to email me. I'm actually heading out to New York, and I'm gonna have a really busy for the next 8 to 10 days. So I may not be able to answer a whole lot of emails while I'm out there. But I will respond. And if you guys need any information, I would be happy to give it to you. So please feel free to email me and ask me any questions you might have. Yes. The music teacher, she was here this morning. I'm not sure if she's still here, but she is. We have multiple music teachers. We have choral directors, band directors, orchestra directors. So they are around. If you want to grab me afterwards, I can get you her information. Very much so. I really feel like it's important to pull us all together because a play production really is everything coming together. So yes. Yes. Very important. I think that, again, it's when you break everything down and unless you're all speaking the same language, there's no point. We spend a lot of time on theater architecture. We talk about, and we actually stage it. I will put the kids in the round and say, okay, we're going to stage this small scene. And we'll do goofy scenes. We'll do like, oh no, my goldfish is dead. And we'll do it in the round. And then we'll do, oh no, my goldfish is dead, and stage it in thrust. And then we'll do, oh no, my goldfish is dead, in a proscenium style. So that they, and if you use the same piece over and over again, they can see the differences. It's hard when you're changing a play every time, like, okay, now we're gonna do, oh no, my goldfish is dead in the round, and then we're gonna do, I need groceries, and I have to go to the store in thrust. If you change the play, they don't necessarily see the differences. But if you did, and you can do something as, you know, a one-page skit that you guys write, and that helps them figure out the different styles of acting. But yes, we go over terminology, technical, hard, soft, tech. We do everything because it is really important for them to kind of. I kind of compiled it on my own. I compiled it on my own, and we do tests and quizzes on it. So, but you can find that, and I mean, there's a great book called The Stage Manager's Handbook. You can get it at Barnes & Noble or Borders, anywhere. It's fantastic. It really, it's basically like how you are a stage manager. And let's face it, stage managers are pretty much the wizard behind the curtain. They do everything. So that will give you a lot of that. I'm sorry? I do. Yes. Mm-hmm. A play to start with. So what grades would this be for? Okay. I love. Okay, the question was, what's a good start jumping off point play? You know what I really love doing? I love doing children's theater, which you'd think at first is too babyish. It's not. There's children's theater that's written for older kids to do. There's a great play called Still Life with Iris, I believe. There are all sorts of children's theater shows now, especially that are coming out. And you can even do old classics. We did. In college, I directed college students in Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. And the reason it's a good jumping off point is it appeals to everybody. So you've got a huge audience coming. And let's face it, when the kids get that reaction, that yay, we loved it, they get hungry for more. Its content is not even a problem, so you don't have to worry about that. And with children's theater, it forces you to go all the way to one extreme. So you're acting out here, you're singing, you're dancing, you're running, so that when you eventually go into other plays, you've already gone to that extreme. You know how the directors are always like, let me pull you back, let me pull you back. Do that with your play. Give them the extreme and then pull them back. So I love doing children's theater. If it's not children's theater, doing plays that sort of have those physical elements, comedies, comedies in some ways are harder than tragedies, but I mean, when you're trying to build excitement about a program, pick something funny. I pick shorter stuff, or I cut it. Again, that's where public domain comes in really handy, because you don't have to worry about paying royalties and fees and getting publishers' permission for cutting. I love Molière. I love Oscar Wilde. Now, granted, that's really wordy, but it's funny. When you read it, you laugh out loud. You just think it's great stuff. And So does that help you? Does that answer your question? When you introduce, how long does it take between introducing it to the kids and then final performance date? When I do a high school play, now granted I've kind of worked out all my kinks, but I'll introduce the play right away, probably first couple weeks of school. We'll start rehearsing. We'll rehearse for about 6 weeks to 8 weeks, depending on how the holidays fall and things like that. And then we do the production. So 2 or 3 months. I mean, when it's an educational thing, sometimes you like it to span most of the semester. And depending on how often you can see the kids, that makes a big difference. If you stretch it out too far, your kids are going to taper off, and they're going to lose interest. They're either going to peak too soon and then drop off, or they're going to get bored, or they're going to put off learning their lines, and so on and so forth. So I would say don't spend more than 3 months. I mean, 2 months is really sufficient, I would say. Yes. Mm-hmm. Public domain, yes. And anything written within the last 100 years, anything written before 1900. So, well, thank you very much, you guys. I really appreciate you coming in. Feel free to email me.